Hello, and welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Steven.
And I'm Marshall.
And this is the show where we talk about the political economy of speculative fiction. That is, how decisions are made, how wealth is distributed, and how friends will go to the ends of the galaxy to help each other. Today we're extremely lucky to have a guest joining us. Kat Rambo is an accomplished author with over 250 fiction publications in Asimov's, Clark's World Magazine, the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. They are a past president of the SFWA.
Their most recent works are an anthology, The Reinvented Heart, from Ark Manor, published in publishing in February of 2022, co-edited with Jennifer Brozek, as well as a space opera, You Sexy Thing, published by Tormgmillen on November 16th, 2021, that we are discussing today. Welcome to the show, Kat.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So, You Sexy Thing follows a Captain Nico and her motley crew of space warriors turned gourmet chefs. The book opens on them on the cusp of their evaluation for a prestigious award, and I don't know how I'm going to pronounce this correctly, the Necklin Orb. That's when everything goes wrong. They soon fall in with a super advanced bioship, the You Sexy Thing, and are whisked away on a high intrigue adventure involving coups, dynastic struggle, pirates, and more.
That is it.
That is that. I don't want to give any covers away. How'd I do?
I've been doing these tours. I've been asked to kind of give the log line so many times, and it's delightful to hear somebody else do it.
I always try. People like it. So, but okay, you'd say that is a fair and accurate.
Yeah. It's very accurate. Yeah. Although I say Nicolin Orb.
That's what Nicolin. I was going to ask about. I'm always curious about how people pronounce the things that they write. And writing is such a wonderful medium because I never know how to say the things in the books.
And that's one of the things you learn as a writer is at some point, particularly for science fiction and fantasy writers, they come to you and they're like, here's the audiobook and we have this list of words that we don't know how to pronounce. And you look at them and you're like, well, I'm not sure I know how to pronounce those. You learn to watch out for that.
I also just wrote them and didn't ever have to say them. So
Yes, I mean, so Nicolin Orb kind of being a turn on the Michelin star.
Yes, absolutely.
That's fun. So I believe this is it's like a future because there's talk about the Milky Way and references to the hot chocolate song, You Sexy Thing. I think that's what the song's called. I don't actually know.
Yeah.
Yes, it's called.
It is.
Yeah. So presumably this is our universe in our future, right?
Okay. Yes. The far future or a kind of. I don't know exactly what time it is. Future, perhaps.
Pretty far away. So a world in which like You Sexy Thing is a very esoteric reference.
Yes.
Quite opaque, like referencing Tacitus or.
That's it. It's exactly like that.
Yeah. Okay, that's
those are the futures I like because we reference Tacitus. On the regular, so the more esoteric, the better.
You wish we referenced Tacitus on the regular.
Yeah, not on the show, but maybe in life.
Name me one Agricola reference we've made on this podcast. Yes, in life, yes.
That puts us in like the top 1% of Agricola references on podcasts, though.
Anyway, so you've crafted quite a wonderful universe here for us. Really, really was a joy to read. And there's one of the things we're, because being the podcast we are, where we like to, I'd say we're more Watsonian in our analysis, and less Doylist. We're more interested in the explanations of the characters.
Okay. Right.
Like that's how Watson would explain something versus Sir Arthur Conan Doyle would explain something. I stole that. A friend of mine told me this, so I'm incorporating it.
I like that.
I'm co-opting it. I'm sure it's from somewhere. But yes, so kind of the in-universe explanation for things is kind of interest to us. So there's quite a few factions and governments and kind of like spacefaring civilizations. It's crowded out there, right?
It's crowded, and humans aren't the majority in any sense of the word.
But they are very horny, which I liked.
Yes.
The perception amongst aliens is that we're slutty. Yeah.
From what I've seen of the world,
well, there's quite a few governments, you know, obviously, and there's some states mentioned. But one of them, the one that is most of interest to us, the one that Nico is in the military for, ostensibly, is the Holy Hive Mind.
The Holy Hive Mind. The ranks of the Holy Hive Mind. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so kind of how does their decision-making structure differ from, like, you know, most contemporary states?
So the Holy Hive Mind literally conscripts people in that it doesn't do this with all of its soldiers, but the ones that it has that it feels are valuable, it basically sort of sucks them into this conglomeration of minds, which means basically, you know, it's not like a fate worse than death. It's basically a alternate fate where you're just basically in this army mind for the rest of your existence, which sounds kind of shitty to me.
Yes.
Fair enough.
They only really take soldiers into that hive mind. They don't absorb it like a philosopher or...
Oh, they do. Well, it has to have some tactical value. So absolutely, like generals and tacticians, but, you know, not like artists would just distract them. And philosophy, probably, they're not going to let that sort of dangerous, seditious thought in there. No, probably not.
Yeah.
They're still a military after all. Yeah. All right. Okay, yeah.
That does seem like a terrible fate.
So they have this hive mind that's kind of made of a curated list of experts, and they also they all kind of think on problems that the holy hive mind faces.
Right. Yes.
And so it's like a military dictatorship that runs. Okay.
When you're writing space opera, you want to kind of have a bunch of different types of governments and not make, you know, not sort of like I'm going to replicate 21st century Earth politics or something like that. And so I tried to kind of make it a decent mix, and some of them be, I don't know, kind of very outer spacey.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. The other one I think that kind of gets a lot of play in this is the Paxians. As I understand it, they're a monarchy. They have a sovereign, but their sovereign is also like, through life extension therapy, is able to live like an inordinately long period of time.
Yeah.
So their succession is like, succession is infrequent.
Yes. There's always somebody there to succeed, but they may not get called on.
Right. And that successor is chosen through a very competitive and very like mind bending process. Apparently it's very difficult to be an heir.
Yeah, they seem to go through heirs faster than they go through the monarchs themselves.
Yeah.
Did the monarch also say, or somebody say, that the monarch has clones? So, like, until they're removed from power?
They don't have power.
Oh, they didn't? Okay.
No, they don't have clones. Actually, clones kind of play into a book, too. I've kind of sort of thought out the philosophy and mechanics of clones, and they're actually pretty regulated.
Good.
Because there are definitely post-mortal societies out there, right? There are people who die, you know, you can die and then your brain states just get uploaded and you just print it off.
And you can only have one sort of clone in existence at any time. And so like the mind, the memory stuff can get transferred, but you couldn't like have multiple clones of yourself. That would be highly illegal.
No one would ever do it, and it certainly would never come up. Yeah. Good.
People would certainly, I mean, at least people with clones, would certainly remember to back up their brains regularly, though. That would be a...
Yeah.
Every Sunday night, you don't miss it.
You might lose something important otherwise.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess my question is, I think like the Holy Hive Mind, with a very like multivalent consciousness, and then like the kind of incredibly long-lived Paxians, like how do you think they would address like some of our current policy challenges? Like how do you think they would do climate change? And I know that might be, that's a difficult question. How do you think they would handle like one of these like really tough issues facing us?
I think so much more ruthlessly and efficiently than we do, right? And just being, nope, this is happening. And yeah. There wouldn't be any like, oh, let's get buy-in. No. And it would be. It would be super. And the holy hive mind particularly would be incredibly efficient about it. The Paxians would be ruthless, but less efficient, I think.
Yeah. What they lack in efficiency, they make up for in ruthlessness. Okay.
That's right. It's okay. A sort of sense of style, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in this future, are there still democracies that exist? Or
oh, sure.
Is that... Okay.
No, yeah, there's all just, time.
Yeah. I've yeah. always thought a democracy seems like a difficult thing to maintain in a intergalactic or interplanetary federation of or whatever. I don't want to call it an empire because it's a democracy. But
it's still going to, unfortunately, or at least to my way of thinking, it's still going to need a certain amount of force backing itself up just to keep itself from getting co-opted by other forces.
Yeah. And to think like countries in our world, you know, have different issues that they face. And so they elect different governments.
Oh, yeah.
Applying that to a planet. And you're like, well, I don't want to elect the government that's going to stop that planet from, you know, devolving orbit. That's a very expensive problem that doesn't affect me at all. No, thanks.
Well, and then think about like if you've got then not just sort of planetary politics, but let's say you've got a solar system with multiple planets and, you know, it gets kind of, I think, really interesting and complicated. My father taught political science. And so I get interested in kind of like governments and how they get shaped and what happens with them, and particularly economics of stuff as well.
Yeah. Leads into it for me is that like, what is driving somebody like the Holy Hive Mind's expansion? Like what, why are they constantly? Yeah. What do they get out of it?
With them, it's that sort of, I think one of the most pernicious mindsets, that sort of we are right and must impose that rightness on the rest of the universe, which I think does unfortunately come into play, right? I mean, look at the Catholic Church and the various, mm-hmm. the witch hunts, not necessarily today, I don't think, but...
Still sometimes today.
It's like people need to know what living in this society is like everywhere.
You know, people say that science fiction, it's just about our time, but kind of with a particular filter on it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true.
Oh, there's definitely people in the world today who think, hey, people need to be living like I'm living. there's no shortage of that going around. So
yeah. So they're not doing it for like an economic reason. It's more of like a moral imperative.
Yeah. With them, it's more of a moral imperative. Yeah. And then I would say with Paxian folks, it's much more about money and who's controlling resources there. And that's right. Because they have less of them. I mean, the Holy Hive Mind has been going for so long and so efficiently that by now they just have huge amounts of resources.
Too big to fail.
That's it.
Because it is interesting because there is like, I guess then there's lots of planets and I guess they can all, or there's enough people doing enough different stuff that they, it's viable for them to trade. Like,
right.
One of the things you're talking about is like how like kind of like, because space is, I mean, I guess also space travel is pretty cheap because they have,
right.
They have a logistics systems, the gates, right?
Right. Yeah,
so they can affordably transport stuff, which makes trade viable. And then I guess question, does empire lead to trade or does trade lead to empire? Do we have thoughts on that?
I think they're kind of inextricably connected, right? I mean, yeah. But that's, I just finished recently, what is the book by Seth Dickinson? It's a trilogy, The Trader, Baru Cormorant, which is just crazy wonderful. But in that, right, that's how the empire spreads itself, is as much through trade as through conquest.
Lenin would say empire is the highest stage of capitalism. So
yeah.
Where trade goes, piracy follows. Right.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, and we mentioned earlier there's pirates. What do you want to say about like piracy and pirates and
the pirates are there partially because when I was writing, I was kind of like, complications ensue. I kind of in this lump, and later on, like, it was like, what will I do? Well, maybe it'll be pirates. But one of the reasons I picked Space Pirates is because a long time ago, when I first stepped up to edit Fantasy Magazine, it was in the months after there had been three different pirate anthologies and two magazine theme anthologies. And it was because Pirates of the Caribbean had just come out and everybody was like, oh, pirate fantasy. And so I read through so much pirate slush. And it wasn't even good pirate slush. It was pirate slush that had been through, you know, like four other editors. So I was getting the freaking dregs of this, right? And I was just like, and then for like years afterwards, you know, I could be doing a call for a story, you know, anthology or whatever. I'd just be like, no fucking pirates, you know, or more politely, pirates will be a very hard sell. And so that's a little bit kind of poking fun at myself with the space pirates, too.
I have a question about when does a pirate become a pirate? And when does it like stop being a pirate and just become like an aggressive neighboring society,
a belligerent? When are you a pirate? Yeah, when are you a combatant?
Well, I think with the pirates, they're very, you know, they're just so much smaller, right? And they don't have that cloak of legitimacy that when countries, like when we get to a point where it's kind of actual governments and they can't just be like, well, we're going to go out and prey on people. They have to kind of gussy it up and go, oh, we have letters of marque and, you know, we have declared hostilities, and they have to do it in a much more genteel way. I'm not sure there is a difference beyond the gentility of that, actually.
Once the people you're stealing from recognize you, you stop being a pirate.
Well, that's it. And I think we talk about like the rules of war, right? We're very big on the rules of war, and you don't kill civilians, right? Is one of the rules of war, one of the rules of engagement. It's just fancy wrapping paper on a really kind of brutal and awful thing that's happening, right? Because now what happens is those civilians get killed, but we call it collateral damage, right? It's they're not even given.
Yeah, it was an accident, so it doesn't count.
It was an accident. Like, who could be blamed? The drone went in the wrong direction, and that's just bullshit, right?
President Obama fixed the drone cat, like fixed the civilian casualty problem by just reclassifying all adult males as combatants.
And
the civilian casualties went way, way down. Anyway,
that's about the words, right? And that's something that we've seen in the American government. It is just gone crazy about it. We don't care about truth. We just care about the words that are used to label things. Sorry, my thorough leftist side is coming out here.
Hey, no, more of that.
But it's funny because I, when I was the president of CIFWA, I got, by sort of necessity, good at communicating with some of the more conservative science fiction writers, to the point where somebody said, oh, you know, you've become CIFWA's old white dude wrangler or whisperer. And I was like, well, a certain amount of truth to that. But, you know, and so as a result of that, I've gone on a couple of somewhat conservative podcasts. And I actually really like the ones where we can kind of joust comfortably. And there is a kind of, you know, it's not, you know, there is some go back and forth, and maybe they bait me a little and I just go, ha ha, I'm not going to take it, you know.
Right. I see what you did there.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely like a rule of government, though, is that like we do what we want to do and we'll make it legal however we need to. Right. Like nothing we do is illegal because we make the rules.
That's it. If you handle the definitions, you get to decide what everything is.
Yeah. So pirates are only pirates because somebody labeled them as pirates rather than recognizing maybe that they had a legitimate grievance. And
oh, yeah, because you always have. I mean, and particularly Right now, it's interesting, in my area in Seattle, there is a lot of tension over homeless, and a lot of tension over people. Like, for example, there's a guy who lives up the block from me that's living under the bridge and has been living there for about 8 months. And there is a kind of like weird combativeness and a sort of, I think sometimes on neighbors, they get kind of pissy about these people. But on the other hand, these are folks that just want a place to live, right? They're not living under the bridge because they're like, gee, I am, you know, like Thoreau rejecting society and deciding to live under a bridge. They're doing it because they don't have an alternative. And so, yeah, maybe the pirates don't have alternatives.
Yeah. And maybe sometimes the pirates are right.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because I guess... Because for whenever piracy, this kind of goes to a pet theory we have on this show, kind of about piracy, how like piracy only really occurs when wealth transfer is happening. So if you look like historically on Earth, piracy, as we kind of know it, you know, the pirates of the Caribbean came about because of the looting of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Right. So the colonial powers were hauling all that were.
Oh, vast amount.
Siphoning all the wealth out of the Caribbean and taking it back to Europe. And that made, that created the conditions under which piracy was viable at all.
Yeah. There's no money in stealing from peasants, right? They don't. What are you going to get? Turnips.
So who is it? I mean, like, do the pirates, do they, is there a particular target for them? Are they like, the Paxians are the ones that have it, or is it, the hive mind is too dangerous?
You're getting into stuff that I have not thought in depth about, but that I'm going to have to, because I have basically 9 more books to go through, and so the pirates are definitely going to be wandering through there. So it's true. I mean, that's one of the things I love about talking to people, is often I get ideas from discussions like that, and I think that my pirates will emerge more interesting from this one.
Is it going to be like that many saga?
So basically, Tor gave me a 3-book deal, and at some point, and I was like, okay, they're all going to be linked, and they were like, oh, okay, we really like this first book. And I talked to my editor at one point, and I said, you know, I want this to be a 10-book series. I've got a kind of arc sort of very, very, very roughly graphed out. And he said, well, you know, I wouldn't mind that, but I, you know, push comes to shove when like I go back to Tor and I'm like, it's time for the next 3 books. What are you going to do? But the nice thing is I originally wrote this book to self-publish. I was like, I see people that are doing really well with self-publishing, and I'm going to just sit down and write a book that I have fun with. And I'm going to write the kind of book I love, and I'm just going to fill it full of banter and humor and some, you know, smart ass stuff. And then I went to my agent and was like, okay, you need to sign off on this so I can self-publish it. And he wouldn't. If he's listening to this, sorry, Seth, but he hadn't sold any books yet. Right. You know? And so he's just like, no, you can't have it. Right. And they're like, no. So it was a big struggle. And then, by God, he sold it, which just astonished me. So, hooray.
Either way, it gets made. So
that's it. So if Tor does the first 3 books and then are just like, yeah, we're going to part ways, I can always go self-publish, right? You know, or maybe somebody else would want it. But I love these characters. I really love writing them. And I want to get all 10 books done just because they're so much fun to play with.
They are super fun. Yes. Yeah, it is. It's true. We've talked a lot about politics, you know, and like armies and governance. But it's actually like mostly just about people with like weird, strange powers and complex and fun histories, like getting into wacky situations. So
it's super influenced by Farscape, which I just love. I love, you know, kind of found family stuff. And I wanted a crew where you didn't have, where the humans were kind of, there weren't that many of them, because aliens are fun.
They are. A question that just popped into my head. Is magic real, or is it just like an unexplained science?
It is real.
Okay.
It is real. Because this book started as military fantasy. And I had read this book, right, on self-publishing, and like, find a niche, you know, like, military fantasy is hot. I was like, okay, I don't know what that is, but soldiers matter. So that's why the twins were were-tigers, was I was writing away, and I was like, well, I better get some magic in here. Let's throw in the were-tigers, you know, were-lions. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love it. And it just sort of is, it's just there and people accept it. And it's like, yeah, they did some magic on them and now they're were-tigers and it's fine.
Yeah.
Don't think too hard about it.
That's it.
Yeah. And it has a religion with itinerant monks.
Yeah.
And it has, you know, it's like, oh, there's a whole theology there and, you know, it's, that's really fun. Yeah. So yeah, it's great. It was really great. Yeah. And, we're excited. Awesome. We're excited to see these things fleshed out more subsequently. So, I did want to talk about Nico and her crew because like you said, they have an interesting work arrangement, because they, on the one hand, they are, you know, busboys and garçons de cuisine and so on. But they are also conscripts of a military force. And this is something I personally like worry about at night. just because, you know, like volunteer armies in the developed world. I don't know if many people already don't know this, but essentially how most armies work now is they just buy 100% of your time. Like when you sign a contract with like the in Canada, like if you sign a contract with the Canadian Army, you're like, I'm giving you like every 7 days, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 5 years. And you sign that contract and then that's how they use you. Obviously you're not like working all that time, but, that's what they do. Right. And I'm kind of terrified that these types of working arrangements, the military kind of proves them as a concept and they can spread it into the wider society. It's sort of the kind of question. There's a question in there, but what's like work like, you know? What kind of, is there any protections for workers?
Oh, that's it's going to be dependent on the place that you are. Like the place where they start out, the space station called Twice Far is actually a place that I have written a number of short stories. And the thing I love about Twice Far is it's constantly cycling through governments because it's constantly getting taken over by different groups. And it's like, oh shit, now the taxes are this way. And it's like, oh God damn it. Now we're, you know, so that's always going on. So there, the regulations vary depending on the government that is currently in power and what opinions they have about things like food safety. Usually when one first rebels, you don't really worry too much about that.
Right. Yeah. So there's different labor conditions are dependent on on the jurisdiction, which makes absolute sense. Yeah. Who do you think like, cause they end up in a kind of a different, they end up kind of a different arrangement at the end of the book. Do you think one of them could quit? Not that they will, obviously, but
I think anything could happen. Right. And that's one of the things that's fun about the team. And the kind of the found family, because, you know, whenever you've got people interacting, you're always going to have some bumping up against each other and some problems. And of course, in the course of this book, one of them does something pretty kind of awful to the rest of them. And that gets played out in book two.
If one of them were to quit the restaurant business, would they automatically revert to being a soldier? No? Okay.
No, I did. They all don't want to be soldiers. They all have had that existence, and part of them is that they don't want to take up arms again.
Yeah. I just wasn't sure if it was sort of like a contractual or something obligation of like, if you're not doing this, you're fighting somebody. Oh.
If they're not doing this, yes, the Holy Hive Mind will pull them back in.
Okay.
The only way to escape the Holy Hive Mind is by saying that we are cooks, we are artists at food.
Right.
I know. What a weird, what a weird and fun quirk. But I think that's also kind of how those things work, right? Like typically the more crazy you are, the more you need to have some grounding.
Yeah.
General principles in your wild political project. So that's good.
That's it.
I mean, it's definitely a great way to have employee retention, right? It's like,
oh yeah,
you don't want to be a busboy. That's fine, but you're going back to the front lines.
Going back in, yeah.
No, that's okay. I'll stay here. Stephen, when you were talking about the idea of soldiers and your fear of that as a labor thing, I thought you were talking more about that armies would lend out their soldiers for other tasks. I'm thinking of we've got this labor shortage right now, and there's all these stories about retirees who are donating their time to restaurants that they like.
Oh,
because
yeah.
The restaurant is we couldn't find any staff. And I'm like, well, did you try raising your salaries? No, not that. We're quite willing to have a retired senior come in and do stuff for us for free because we can afford that.
I teach a class on kind of narratives and stories. And one of the stories that I think is really interesting, and if you go around, you'll find literally hundreds and hundreds of incidents of this. And it's always some child who has opened up a lemonade stand and is supporting a homeless shelter or is, doing, whatever. And you're supposed to go, oh, this is so heartwarming. Oh, this child's adorable. And you're not supposed to say, well, what kind of fucking society is it that kids have to step in and fill the gaps, right?
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah, yeah, yeah. These 12-year-olds held a bake sale to buy a car for their janitor who had to walk to work every day, but now he can drive to school. You're like, what?
Yeah. Maybe there should be public transportation available to everyone. It's just, it drives me nuts.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. I mean, what do the kids on Twitter say? Posting your L's. You have something that really is a deeply embarrassing fact about yourself, but you're goddamn proud of it. It's really the kind of thing we should be ashamed of, sure. My last thing I had, and this is a fixation of our show, is AI ships. They're a big problem for us. I like in this book, because this is a live question in this book, is You Sexy Thing the ship, which is a very intelligent and aware ship, is it a slave?
That is such a good question. That is, and it is originally, and that's I think one of the things that part of the progress over the course of the book is I want to do some stuff with that. Because I totally agree. And that's one of the problems with AIs, how shitty would it be to be a being and have everybody be like, yes, we created you to work for us, and to be like, whoa, gee, I don't know.
Hold on a second.
Yeah.
Do I get a say in this?
Well, and that's my fantasy novels, the Tibet books, the kind of the premise in those is that there's these intelligent magical creatures whose work and sometimes physical bodies drive the economy, and where they've been kind of given this elaborate justification as to kind of go, well, this is the natural order. And they're finally going, well, wait a minute. Is it actually the natural order? What are the stories we're being told?
Mm-hmm.
We're thinking about.
Oh yeah. Cause we are hurtling into some very major, ethical dilemmas as a society. Again, lots of people say this and write about this, but the idea, even the word robot, right? It's the Czech word for slave, right?
Maybe one of the things that I've always loved about David Brin's books is that he's got this future where humanity's terrible, dirty secret is that they cause the extinction of literally thousands of species, because each of those represents a potential intelligent race. And so they're in this kind of weird position where they just cannot let anybody know this. Right. It's fascinating. So what do we do if we start augmenting the intelligence of creatures, right? What are their rights?
Yeah. Well, I mean, even without augmenting, we talked about this with, the album of Dr. Moreau with a guy.
Daryl Gregory. Do you want to take that again, Marshall?
Oh, Daryl Gregory. He's great.
No, I'm going to leave it as it is.
Okay. All right.
We talked about sort of like the uplifting creatures, but also like that animals right now are pretty intelligent.
Oh, yeah.
As they are. And the more we learn about intelligence, we're like, oh, boy, what have we been doing to these things for so long? How can we ever live with ourselves?
Well, did you see there's a YouTube video recently that went around, I think, during the pandemic. And it was a person who is a speech something or other. And she had a mat. And basically the dog could be like this, and it would spell out different words, which I love. But I was so excited about this. I got this for my cousin, and I was like, so, you know, tell me how Baxter does with this mat. Like, what is he going to say? Like, what is the dog going to communicate to you? And I said, so Patty, how did it go? And she's like, well, he discovered the cookie button. And then he just sat there. Cookie, until she finally had to take it away.
That's not happening.
We may not want to know exactly what it is.
But then, yeah, just the idea that like we grow a new life, like these ships, and we're like, yeah, we'll grow them over a lifetime. And then just use them forever.
Yeah, that's deeply problematic, right? That's hugely problematic. And it should be.
Are there other AIs? I'm often curious about AI in general, like the idea of intelligence, of like how is an artificial intelligence any different than our own intelligence? But are there other AIs that exist beyond these like live ships?
Oh yeah. There's some out there. And I think AIs are such an interesting thing to talk about in science fiction, because one of the things that people do is they start imposing gender stuff on them, and it makes no freaking sense, right? They're just like, why? Computers aren't going to be like, I want to play mommy and daddy, right? It's just ridiculous. There are AIs out there. There's certainly awesome. Lots of different intelligences. It's been a lot of fun to kind of.
Annalie Newitz in Autonomous.
Oh yeah.
Had some AIs that were sort of like rushed into like adulthood, and then some that were allowed to sort of like grow up and have a childhood. And
yeah.
I really liked that sort of conception of them, that they're like, yeah, this is an intelligent being that, you know, needs time to mature. And these ships seem to have that kind of a thing to them, where it was like, yeah, they can't just come out of, like, they're not just out of the shipyard and flying. Like, it takes some time to incubate and.
Yeah. To develop the emotional intelligence, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's certainly not done by the time that it's out. Like, when the crew interacts with it, it's like constantly learning new things. And it's like, I've never thought of that emotion.
I just, that is the most fun to write. And I actually, the ship is in some degree modeled after a cat that I had that I loved, who was just the world's friendliest cat and also not the world's brightest cat. And I'm like, this is Raven. He's in that ship somewhere bouncing around.
The sexy thing has an owner named Tack Raven.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tack Raven, a villain, hero or villain?
What is he? That's a good question, right? Eccentric millionaire.
Did not know how to feel about that. Yeah.
I mean, my own biases coming through here. Whenever I see somebody with that much money, I'm like, so this is a villain by definition.
Lots of possibilities.
Every billionaire is a policy failure. So
that's my sort of feeling naturally, right? That's just like, oh, the billionaires are they're the evil Lex Luthers.
Yeah. And it's, you know, like, I don't know how much of a spoiler it is, but him letting the crew stay on You Sexy Thing and, you know, travel around for a while is as beneficial to him as it is to them. It's like, yeah, well, I have this entirely unique thing that you guys have trained for me, and it's still mine. I still own it.
Yeah.
Which is pretty villainous.
Some more popping up with that. Well, and you know, nobody gets to be, like, at least in our society, nobody gets to be a billionaire without being kind of a dick, right? You know, it's just without exploiting people ruthlessly. So there are no billionaires out there that have kind of gotten to it through a path of altruism.
Just stumbled on it.
Oh, God, yeah.
I woke up this morning and I was a billionaire. I don't know.
I used to work at Microsoft for Bill Gates, right? And you would see Bill wandering around every once in a while. And he was always regarded as a sort of not quite human figure. I mean, and not in a pejorative way, but just sort of like bigger than the rest of us.
Yeah. The opposite of pejorative.
don't set my chip off, Bill, please.
Post-jorative.
That's it. Oh, God.
Yeah.
And still is, arguably. Both people who think he is God and the devil. And neither of those things are true.
He has done, like, here in Washington, he's donated a lot of money to good causes. And then his dad has been one of the people who's really tried to get the income tax for billionaires passed, which I think would be a good idea, but I'm not a billionaire, so, you know, go figure.
Yeah, I think a complicated figure whose story is not done being written, so
that's it.
There's more to be accounted for, I guess.
There's more stories to come, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Are there any sort of, like, pieces of like governance or economics in this book that you're, like, really proud of that we haven't asked you about that you're like, oh, you gotta talk about this?
God. I hate to tell you no, but no. No, I mean, honestly, I wrote this book. I sat down. I was like, I'm going to write a military fantasy. And I started writing. And suddenly there were these two people arguing about an eggplant. And it just sort of went from there. And certainly, like, you go back right after over a first draft and find all the places where you could do things more smartly. But it was a remarkably clean draft for me. I was very happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the if I were fiddling with it, the only thing I would change now is I would put more food in it now. And actually book two has, I think, more interesting food stuff in it. And that's partially because Tor were the people who came up with the Great British Bake Off meets Farscape comparison. And I was kind of like, well, you know, do you think there's enough food in there for that? And they were just like, yeah, sure. Like, okay. It's been this kind of bewildering thing where kind of like every once in a while, this mysterious kind of like marketing says X will get delivered to me. And I'll just be like, okay. I don't know.
I'm not a trained scientist by any means, but, like, okay. My wife has her master's of science. You know, she, my brother-in-law is doing his PhD right now in, like, in, like, plant pathology and stuff. So I'm really interested in kind of, like, biology and science and things like that. Just as, and you're talking about how, like, any restaurant needs to be able to feed multiple species. And I just, you were describing in the book, and I'm just having a panic attack. Like, I'm just like, oh my God. Oh no. Oh no.
Well, that's it.
That's part of getting the nickel in orb. You know, you got to be able to, like, feed whoever. And I was like, oh my God, that's wild. Yeah. That's very fun. Very fun.
And
very
I think that would be such a hoot, right? And it would just, book two, I have a lot more fun with that. And then book three, I'm going to do more yet because I'm just having a blast with them.
It was a really great insight that I think is often just sort of ignored, passed over, of like, these aren't all the same animals. They can't all just eat the same things.
Yeah. Well, and you're already kind of fudging it because everybody's on a space station, and is the atmosphere good for everybody?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I did enjoy the reverence of that eggplant. right, that it was like the rarity of having an actual grown vegetable, and you're like, this is expensive. It's an eggplant, but it's expensive. Somebody grew this in soil.
Soil they had to take care of it. Yeah, it's there's some time investment there in that eggplant.
Yeah, it's not And, you know, like dirt is such a thing, you know, we say cheap as dirt, but on a space station to have gotten, like, to have moved dirt is just as expensive as moving anything else.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah. And I think it really speaks to this thing about, like, you know, science fiction fans, you know, we dream of the stars or whatever. We talk about how great it would be to leave Earth, but the Earth is such an incomparable treasure.
Yeah.
Right. The value of the Earth is so remarkably vast. You know, and I think sometimes we tend to just like fix it. Well, we'll move out into the stars, or we'll move out into space or whatever. But what we have on Earth is so valuable, and it's cool to see that being shown more and more in science fiction, like you're doing it with your eggplant, and I think, you know, S.A. Corey in their books about space, really hammering on this fact, like, no, space is not where you go to have no problems. You go for more problems to space.
Right.
More space, more problems. It's good. It's important. It's a good trend in science fiction, and it's great you're writing about it.
Well, I think it's more about the economics, right? It's a bit more realistic because the spaceships are made out of, you know, they're manufactured objects, as opposed to Star Trek, where it was sort of like everything just sort of got created by the replicators, and it was a very clean post-scarcity economy, right?
Yeah, if you're not post-scarcity, things are still very tricky.
Still very tricky, yeah. Yeah.
And as invaluable as the Earth is, it seems like the parts of it that are invaluable are also the parts that are sort of like the least scarce for us.
Oh, yeah.
And that we treat the absolute worst.
Oh, yeah. All the stuff that we should be, you know, really working to conserve, like the air and the water and public lands. And we just, we're terrible about it.
Just shit all over all of that.
Yeah.
It's wild. And so then when you're like, actually, you know, air quality on a space station is incredibly important. And like, that's a rule that you don't break because it will kill all of us.
Yeah.
Quickly.
There is no ground to kind of, you know, there's no fudging ground really so much.
Yeah.
On Earth, you can fudge stuff.
Yeah.
Not for much longer, though.
No.
Well, that's as good a place as any. We did it, Marshall. We did it. We took this very fun, happy book about food and space and pirates, and we brought up the Anthropocene. You did it. Listener, check off your bingo square.
Awesome.
This is the, you know, in fairness, it is a very fun book. I very much enjoyed reading it. It's a quick read. I went through it, you know, faster than I thought I would. And I was just sort of like, this is great. It just jumps along and is the plot is nice. You know, I never felt at a point that I was like, all right, so when's the next thing going to happen? It was, you know, it was all happening.
I think one of the most moments that just really sort of scarred my soul was with one of my first novel. And I went in and I was talking to the bookseller and she said, oh, I really liked your book. But then I was thinking about it and nothing really happens in it. It's like, oh, okay.
Oh, man.
So ever since then, I always try to make sure shit happens.
Oh
God.
That's
I mean, even if that were true, it doesn't. Your book's in very good company. Like most of the English language canon, does something really happen in Pride and Prejudice?
No, I don't want to say in that book's defense, there were like gladiator fights and there were people dying, and I'm not sure where this nothing happens bullshit came from myself.
But we solved that. There's all this stuff.
Does stuff really happen in Paradise Lost?
Yes! Lucifer goes down to hell! That's a pretty big arc.
Nothing really happened.
Nothing really happened.
Angels falling like brimstone from the sky. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Man, Paradise Lost. Jeez. I haven't thought about that since grad school.
I know it's, I've been told that it's a bit gauche or a faux pas, but what are you doing next?
What am I doing next in terms of writing or the next moment? Because I'm about to go play D&D.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. But what am I doing next? I'm going to be reading at Writers with Drinks in San Francisco next weekend. I've turned in book 2 of the space opera, and I'm working on book 3 right now.
Wow, congratulations. That's exciting.
Yeah.
The journey to 10.
That's it.
Hashtag.
See if I make it or not.
Something that we should have warned you about before, but we just like to spring on people. Again, maybe it makes it more organic. Is there anything that you've read, you know, that you're like, oh, I think, you know, your listeners should read or watch this thing that they may not have heard of before?
Yes. I just wrote the introduction for a book to a short story by Margaret St. Clair. And if your readers are not familiar with Margaret St. Clair, she wrote a ton of stories in the 40s and 50s and 8 novels. I think it was something like close to 200 short stories and 8 novels. And her stuff is just so good that you should look for it and find it and celebrate her.
Excellent.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
That is super.
Awesome.
If you want to find out more about our show, we are on the internet at androidsandassets.ca. We are also on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at AssetDroid, where you will find us posting mostly about when our show gets uploaded so you can stay on top of releases as if your podcatcher doesn't already do that for you. But hey, redundancy is the key to success in life. Occasionally, we'll also post things about other things, maybe something interesting we found on the internet, maybe a picture that we saw that was neat. Who knows? You know? Good luck.
Another podcast brought to you by the social media and marketing geniuses of Marshall and Steven. Occasionally, we'll get, you know, engaging internet discussions people are having. With asinine comments, so this is not helping.
If you happen to be listening to this at Worldcon and you're in queue for one of your anticipated panels, maybe just turn us on and let everybody else in the queue listen, because we think they would all enjoy what we're saying.